Oh, say can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations where our children can play in a world without war where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation where the rivers run clean through the forests of green where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our birth, blessed with peace on Earth.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us live at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes America's Path to Permanent War. Harry Chrysler talks with Andrew Basevich, Professor of International Relations and History at Boston University, for a discussion of the causes and consequences of the militarization of U.S. foreign policy. Basevich explores the origins of militarization and the factors that sustain their existence for more than six decades. And then after that, Scott Horton interviews Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern, former senior analyst at the CIA, discusses why the corrupted mainstream U.S. media needs to be supplanted by WikiLeaks to preserve our liberties. They comment on the State Department's successful interference with Spanish and German courts seeking to indict U.S. officials.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Chrysler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Andrew Basevich, who is a professor of international relations at history at Boston University. His new book is Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Andrew, welcome back to our program.
Thank you very much for having me on.
How long did it take you to write the book?
Not long. It's a short book. Once I got going, I think I wrote it in about 8 months, then before it, you know, went into the editing process.
And what is your main point that you want our audience to be sure they understand?
I want them to appreciate the existence and influence of an abiding national security consensus that shapes U.S. national security policy and doesn't work and yet persists because, although not serving the interests of the American people, it tends to serve the interests of Washington itself.
And you conceptualize this analysis around the idea of a Washington credo, which has dominated national security thinking since the end of World War II. What is that credo, briefly stated?
In essence, I argue that the Washington rules have two components. And the first, as you suggested, I call the American credo. And the American credo really is a claim made about America's historic or global responsibility. And the claim reduces to the contention that the United States is called upon to shape the world, lead the world, liberate the world, transform the world. The second component of the Washington rules then relates to how we envision the application of military power in order to meet the self-assigned responsibilities under the credo. And there I cite the existence of what I call the Sacred Trinity. The Sacred Trinity consisting of A, the assertion that the United States and the United States alone must maintain a global military presence. Secondly, that the United States needs to configure its forces not for self-defense, but to provide an instrument of power projection. And third, that in terms of policy, we marry that global presence and those power projection capabilities together to support a pattern of global interventionism. So these two together constitute the Washington rules. These two together provide the means whereby Washington attempts to govern what many people in Washington call the American century.
And this credo calling for an American presence everywhere is not the only part of our tradition. I mean, there is another way to view what the American possibility is about. And you very much see that as an alternative credo, really.
To the extent that we have a mission to the rest of the world, and I think we can have an interesting discussion about what that mission is and how large or imposing it is. But to the extent that we have a mission, there is a longstanding debate in foreign policy, perhaps more or less buried since 1945, a debate over whether we should accomplish our mission by forcefully imposing ourselves on the rest of the world to change it, or whether we should accomplish our mission by serving as an exemplar, by living up to our professed ideals and therefore showing that those ideals may have value for others. And I believe that it is long past time for us to resuscitate and revive this tradition of America as exemplar.
Mm-hmm. Let's pursue the creation of this commitment to global leadership and what you call the American credo. And it's really after World War II that the stage is set. And you quote in your book the first Secretary of Defense, Forrestal, who talked about a semi-war, a near-permanent war. And in fact, the subtitle of your book is The Path to Permanent War.
In the wake of World War II, James Forrestal, in the latter part of World War II, as Secretary of the Navy, he will become, in 1947, the first Secretary of Defense. He was among the first, certainly not the only senior official in Washington, to begin to argue that the post-war world would be one of sustained crisis. Sustained crisis, he believed, that would make it necessary for the United States to remain in a quasi-mobilized posture, to retain much larger military forces, and to be prepared to use them on short notice. And it was Forrestal who coined this term semi-war. My belief is that even though the term tended to fade from common usage, that Forrestal's perception of permanent national security emergency came to pervade the national security establishment. And that alone had enormous implications for our policies.
In your book, as you trace the history of U.S. foreign policy and the militarization of that policy, there is always a tension. There are always alarm bells ringing in the night. And the first one really is President Eisenhower. At the end of his term, warning about the military-industrial complex. Now, everybody remembers that speech, but we don't often remember what he actually said. But he really did sound a warning of the vested interests that would develop and lead to the path that you're describing in your book.
It was a great speech. One wonders why he waited until the eve of his departure in office to sound that warning. I think the record is quite clear in showing that Eisenhower's concern for what he labeled the military-industrial complex had This was a problem that had really bedeviled his administration for years. Eisenhower knew that even though he was the commander-in-chief, that he was not fully in control of national security policies. That, for example, someone like General Curtis LeMay, the longtime commander of Strategic Air Command, that was the old nuclear strike force during the Cold War, that LeMay could easily defy the president, go around the president, work with allies in Congress in order to satisfy his, LeMay's, ambitions to make SAC bigger, to buy more bombers, new bombers, to create more bombs, and so on. So Eisenhower's warning, so prescient, so important, does, I think, deserve to be reread in our own time.
And when, as you walk us through this history, it's very interesting how the development of interests around these ideas that you have defined at the beginning of our discussion become really important. And I want to read a quote from Max Weber, because your book reminded me of this quote: "Not ideas, but material and ideal interests directly govern men's conduct. Yet very frequently the world images that have been created by ideas, like a switchman, have determined the tracks along which action has been pushed by the dynamic of interest." So in the beginning, it's very important that what you had were people like Curtis LeMay and Alan Dulles, who ran the CIA, who essentially created a web of interests that sort of, like a barnacle, attached to these ideas about our role in the world.
Well, I think those are two excellent examples. Alan Dulles, of course, was not the first director of the CIA, but served as director longer than anybody before or since. And Curtis LeMay was not the first commander of SAC, but commanded it through most of the 1950s. I think both of these people were true patriots. They loved their country. They got up in the morning and genuinely believed that they were acting in the best interests of their country. What they could not see was that their conception of what was in the interests of the country was identical with their conception of what was in the interests of either the CIA or SAC. And a concern to build up these institutions, to expand their reach, to enlarge their budget, to increase their number of personnel, ended up, I think, obscuring, making it difficult to see the extent to which the actions of the CIA and of SAC, in fact, were not in the interests of the country. But they couldn't see it. So conviction and self-interest end up merging in ways that have a deleterious effect.
Mm-hmm. And when I read your accounts of both Dulles and LeMay, I was struck by the old line from that period about General Motors and Charlie Wilson,
right,
saying that what's good for General Motors is good for the country, and vice versa.
And I think that kind of thinking pervaded the national security world of the 1950s, and that kind of thinking prevails in the national security world of today. So we live in a moment when Pentagon spending is roughly $700 billion a year, roughly as much, perhaps somewhat more, than the entire rest of the world put together. We live in a moment where we have several hundred military installations scattered abroad. And to work in the Pentagon, I think, whether as an officer or as a civilian, is to inhabit a world in which it has become almost impossible to consider an alternative to those realities, and certainly has become impossible, next to impossible at least, to recognize that those realities, a budget that large, an empire of bases that broad, may in fact be harming the country. And I would say that, in fact, the evidence is quite clear that those kinds of habits are harming the country. The empire of bases is not enhancing global stability. The empire of bases in many places, certainly in the Islamic world, exacerbates instability. The spending, in constant dollars, we are spending more today than we ever spent during the Cold War. Soviet Union is gone, we're spending more money. Certainly is a major contributor, not the only source, but is a major contributor to our trillion-dollar deficits. Trillion-dollar deficits, one year after another, if permitted to continue, are going to bankrupt the country.
In this account, which is a way, another subtitle could be the American tragedy, there are the tragedies of our presidents who essentially come into office and who seem to become trapped by this network of interest. And you make some rather interesting comparisons. And let's start with Kennedy. John F. Kennedy comes in. He's essentially confronted with the plans for the Bay of Pigs. He proceeds half-heartedly. A disaster results. And what are the consequences of that, which is has been set in motion by Allen Dulles' CIA?
Allen Dulles' CIA working under the orders of Dwight D. Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. But that's exactly right. Kennedy had campaigned, among other things, arguing that Eisenhower had been too complacent in allowing the Cuban Revolution to succeed. Elect me president and I'll get tough on Castro. That's the sort of standard rhetoric, I think, in our presidential campaigns. When the subject gets around to national security, I'll be tough. Well, Kennedy wins the election and becomes president, and one of the first things he discovers is that there is this plot to launch Cuban exiles on a cockamamie scheme in which they're going to invade Cuba and set off, supposedly, this great popular uprising that's going to overthrow Castro. I mean, the scheme never had a chance in the world of succeeding. But Kennedy had made himself, to some degree, a prisoner of his own rhetoric and could not afford, he calculated, could not afford to look weak in the eyes of the national security establishment. He would have looked weak had he simply said, this is a dumb idea, I'm not going to do it, kill the program. So reluctantly, as you said, half-heartedly, he agrees to allow the Bay of Pigs operation to go forward, and it does end in a disaster. And he looks like a fool anyway. And then, and this is where I think it becomes even more troubling, the response to failure is to redouble the effort. So the immediate aftermath of the Bay of Pigs sees Kennedy using his brother Robert, the Attorney General, as his chief lieutenant, launching what was called Operation Mongoose, this covert program of sabotage and assassination plots, again, in essence, redoubling their efforts to do what the Bay of Pigs had failed to do. And that, whether Kennedy apologists are willing to admit it or not, set in motion the train of events that culminates in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Because Castro, whatever you think of Castro, he's no fool, understood that the United States was laying siege to his regime, and he sought protection. And he sought protection by turning to an accommodating Nikita Khrushchev, who promised to provide arms to defend Cuba. I'm not defending Castro, I'm not defending Khrushchev. I am saying that were it not for actions like Eisenhower's planned Bay of Pigs and Kennedy's Operation Mongoose, the Cuban Missile Crisis would never have happened.
It's there are a number of things fascinating in this account. One is that the extent to which the Kennedy brothers focused on a vendetta against Castro, which is reminiscent of President Bush's focus on Saddam Hussein.
Oh, I think
whether or not that vendetta is relevant to the policy issue at stake.
No, personalizing the policy, and I think you're exactly right. Much the same thing happened with regard to Saddam Hussein, ends up creating a barrier to sensible strategic thinking. Maybe this is too much 2020 hindsight, but the truth is we've managed to live with Fidel Castro for, 50 years now, his revolution still exists, but it's basically wheezing along, poses no danger to anybody. And you have to say, at least from our current vantage point, what was everybody so excited about? What was everybody so afraid about? And yet we know that that kind of fear led Eisenhower and Kennedy to embark upon incredibly reckless and unnecessary misadventures.
One of the concerns in your book is about what these processes do to our democracy and the extent to which over time the citizenry is no longer informed, that the debates in our elections are not meaningful. I want to focus on this because we see this with the Kennedys. We see it, you know, in recent times after 9/11. And one issue is, as you just said, our presidential candidates run on being strong, mm-hmm. on finding the weakness. One. Two, you point out that when you have a crisis, for example, the Bay of Pigs, a commission is appointed by the president, which then covers up the facts. Basically, which essentially finds the least problematic issue in the context of the larger picture, and then we proceed along the same course. Talk a little about that, because you are suggesting quite powerfully that we don't learn as we experience each decade with a different president. When these issues blow up, when the overall credo is proved to be wanting, we don't change.
Go on home, your house is on fire.
Another campaign lunch of 10K per plate. The waiters will wait as you hook the bait. Choke down the red steak in a house by the lake. Give them both thumbs up and a grin that's fake. Oh, what fun back to Air Force One, where Rove is queuing up a rerun of Top Gun. Hail to the thief is kicking on the speaks. As you linger for a minute to give the finger to the freaks, protesting your plane and your plan and your crew. The daughters are dying while you hide the truth. The daughters are dying while you hide the truth. Caught in Iraq with no one in sight. A guerrilla war zone both day and night. But back at the ranch, you're playing golf on a lawn as uneducated grunts are being treated like pawns. Threaten their hour on the stage as we engage with a rage like rats in your cage. Better hurry up quick and grab a nice cold bucket, nah, pluck it, cause you must be used to this ruckus. Your house has been on fire since you stole it from the people, tearing down our freedom while you're preaching from the steeple. You told the Middle East you were on a mission from God, but while you're wishing on your mission, you created jihad, 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 jihad. You created jihad, a modern day saint for a modern day crusade. Steal what little they have so your friends get paid. You prayed, the rest of us stayed afraid. Flight suit, jump a hump, who thought he had it made? Bring him on, that's what you're yelling. But I'm not buying what you're selling. You treated us with lies, you should be treated like a felon. Felon, you should be treated like a felon. Watermelon all wet between big ears. For the past 2 years you've been preying on our fears. But guess what? Your term is about to expire. The house of cards you built has caught on fire. You better pick up the pace in your political race. Lie after lie keeps smacking us in the face. But look, oh no, the deficit is starting to build. The same news made your dad lose to Bill. Is there more window dressing to put on the sill? As the total jobs lost now total 3 mil? Still, the press refuses to grill. They're more concerned with a shirt from Fat Monica and Bill. When will the truth come home to roost? When will we demand to bring home our troops? When will the press do their job and bring home the scoops? Instead of pulling a line with sound bites and loops. You lied to the people from this great nation. You're destroying the planet for future generations. The largest deficit ever has been your creation. When will Americans lose their patience?
Now for something completely different.